Just occasionally, but invariably the words are these odd descriptive words. In these descriptive passages talking about Sri Krishna's appearance, the poets go out of their way to choose really obscure. Because, you know, it's like if you want to say someone is beautiful, you know, you can't just say beautiful. You have to say beautiful in 10 ways and 10 extraordinary ways. And this is poetry. It's fun. And this is nothing compared to, you know, heavy poetry like Kalidasa, which, and unless you've read a lot of Kalidasa, you'll be going to the dictionary. I would go to a dictionary about every other verse, because his vocabulary is just huge. It's amazing. Of course, and as it is, the Sanskrit vocabulary is huge. Good. Shall we begin? Om Sahana Vavatu Sahanau Bhunaktu Sahavidyam Karavavahai Tejasvinavadhitamastu Mavidvishavahai Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. Very good. We're continuing this evening with the current chapter of Vrindavana Mahatmyam. And this is a chapter which is a compilation of transformation stories. We saw several so far. We saw, I believe, two in our previous class. We saw one in the class after that. And I think we counted a total of 13 transformation stories in this present chapter. We probably won't see all of them because many of them are repetitive. They're almost like carbon copies of preceding ones. We'll see a wonderful transformation story today, the transformation of one rishi named Jabali. Before we do that, let's just reflect for a moment on why so much emphasis on transition, on transformation is the word I'm looking for. And we had a brief discussion about that last week, and we said that our whole process of spiritual growth is a process of transformation. And it's not a minor transformation, it's a radical one. You know, I think scientists like to use this word metamorphosis. Remember that word from your grade school? When that little caterpillar turns into the butterfly, that's not a minor transformation. That's utter, that's complete. Metamorphosis means to take on a brand new form. And the transformation we're engaged in any process of spiritual growth is that kind of radical transformation, which is why every one of these transformation stories has a male rishi transformed into a female gopi. That's a pattern that plays out again and again and again. In the next chapter, it'll be Vyasa's turn. And in the chapter after that, mighty Arjuna gets to be a gopi. So, this transformation then is symbolic of two things we said in the last class. One is that we're so identified with gender, male, female, therefore to change one's gender is the equivalent of the caterpillar becoming a butterfly. And of course, we have no doubt if this text were written by a female saint, it definitely would have had all female sages transformed into gopas. You know, so the fact that they're converted into gopis is partially due to the rather male orientation of the text. But we said in a prior class that there's a further reason for transformation as a gopi. And this is a teaching that's found frequently, especially among Vaishnava acharyas, who are very fond of saying there's only one male in the universe, and that's Bhagavan. with reference to that almighty, all-powerful source of all. You know, by comparison, the rest of us must be, you know, subservient, smaller, weaker female in relationship to that all-powerful Lord. So this reason to also, in the Vaishnava teachings, the idea that to come close to Sri Krishna emotionally, Sri Krishna as a male representation of deity, than to have a female bhava, for all of these reasons. And we'll see some of that coming out in these teachings. A final note, though, on transformation. Just had reflected on something today that I never really thought of before. The word many of you use for memorization is when you say Hindi, when you say kantastha. That's a very interesting term, kantastha. You're all familiar with it more than I. But the literal meaning of it, of course, is stuck in your throat. That's what it means. Of course, we understand it means memorized. But very significant, the choice of words, just as we've discussed before, the choice of the word sneha and mamta, you know, that they have the deeper meaning is very revealing. Similarly, this word kantastha, when something goes in, it gets stuck. I don't know that this is exactly how the word came about, but it seems to make sense. Whatever goes in is supposed to go to the heart, right? But suppose it doesn't make it all the way, it gets stuck. It gets stuck in the throat. Now, of course, that means stuck in the form of words, source of words, and that I think that's probably the real origin of the word. It means that which remains in the form of words which are parroted out of the throat. They go in, they go down as far as the throat, and then they come right back out, like the parrot. But it's a nice image to think, especially in all of our Vedanta classes, in this class, and our Mahabharata class. So every time you come here, we hear all of these wonderful Shastric teachings. They all come in here, and the question is, do they make it down here? Now, to the heart means to the core of your being, so that that process of transformation can take place. So many people have spent decades engaged in spiritual growth and remain virtually unchanged. I've joked about them before. I've humorously say that they've emerged unscathed by all these Vedantic teachings. It's kind of a silly way of putting it. But that happens, and it's really unfortunate. And it happens because the teachings, to use the other meaning of kantastha, the teachings get stuck. They get stuck in the form of concepts, they get stuck in the form of words, they get stuck in the form of abstractions, philosophy, etc. In order for these teachings to bring about transformation, they have to relate to our experience. So, with that in mind, when we come towards the end of the class today, and I'll try to keep the text material a little bit shorter so that I can introduce the meditations a little bit, because in a manner of speaking, the most important part of the class is that meditation. And what we could do, and what perhaps I should have been doing all along, in fact I did do early on, I tried to make a connection between the text and the meditation, but I think the last few classes I just didn't think about it. We just finished the text and started meditating. The text is meant for meditation. The text is meant to invoke in a certain imagery and certain feelings for the sake of meditation. So when we get to the meditation time this evening, we'll try to finish a little early so that we can talk about how these kinds of teachings can be used for the sake of meditation. Okay. So this evening, we have another delightful story. Just one. And it's a little longer story, so it'll take us a while to get through it. It's a story of another rishi. His name is Jabali. And he is... Let's see what happens. Very interesting. The story is a little more involved than the other ones we've seen. Brahmavari Muni Kashchid. This is the second half of verse 21. Jabalhiriti Vishrutaha. So there was Kashchit Munihi, there was some sage whose name was Jabali. He was famous, Vishruta as Jabali, and he was a Brahmavadi. That is, he was a teacher of Advaita Vedanta. This is a term that would be used. And significant, you'll see, as we continue. Satapasurato yogi vicharan prithivi mimam. So he was very devoted to doing tapas. He was a yogi engaged in these practices. And vicharan, he was wandering prithivim imam, this entire world. He was just wandering at will from place to place, as such sadhus are likely to do. Sahe kasmin maharanye yojana yuta visrute yadrichaya gatho pashyat ekan vapim sushobhanam. Ekasmin maharanye, in one vast forest. How vast forest? Yojana ayuta viskrite, spread out for many, many miles in all directions. And he was wandering in that forest, yadrachaya gataha, wandering around at will. Just he doesn't have an appointment to keep, nor does he have to show up at work at 9 o'clock in the morning. So he's wandering, yadrachaya, at will, gataha. And as he's doing so, apashyat, he saw. What did he saw? Ekam vapim, a particular well. A well which was sushobhanam, very beautiful well, an unusual well. Of course, you wouldn't expect to find a well in the midst of a huge forest in the first place. So something's odd about that. Obviously, he's going to find out what's going on. Sarvatasphatika bandha tatan swaduchalanvitam. Very unusual well, because sarvataha, on all of its sides, the sides of the well are spatika bandha. They are the translator translates it as made of glass. I don't think that makes sense. Spatika can also represent a gem, so I would think a better meaning is studded with gems would be a better meaning. So a well in a forest, and a well is studded with gems. Of course, if the well is dry, it's not very useful. But fortunately, this well has swadu jala anvitam. It's filled with very sweet water. So it's not just a beautiful well, but it's a very useful one. I caught myself. I was about to say, it's not just a beautiful well, but it's a useful well as well. Doesn't work. Language is like that. Vikasi kamala moda vayuna parishilitam. In the well are floating some lotus flowers, and the fragrance from the lotus flowers, Vikasika, is just pervading all around Parishilatam. The whole area is pervaded by this beautiful fragrance of flowers floating on the water. Tasya paschim. Tasya paschima digbhage mule vatamahiruhu. Tasya paschima digbhage, on the west side of that well. Mule vata mahiruhu. There's a vata, a fig tree, peepal tree, which is mahiruhu. It's grown very huge. A huge fig tree has grown up. And mule, at the root of this, at the base of the tree, he sees something. What he sees is described in the next verse. Apashyat tapasim kanchit kurvantim darunam tapah. Apashyat, he saw. What did he see? Kanchit tapasim. Tapasim. Some female ascetic engaged in tapas. In fact, not just tapas, kurvantim, she is doing darunam tapaha, very, very severe penance she's doing at the foot of this tree, which is on the west side of the well. Tarunya vayasayuktam rupenati manoharam. She is tarunya vayasa. She is young. She's not, you know, when you think about a meditating female sage, you think of, generally, you think of someone who's very old. This happens to be a young woman sitting there at the foot of the tree. And rupena, and her form, is atimanoharam. She's extremely beautiful. You wouldn't expect to see that in a big forest. So this sadhvi, we'll call her, is sitting at the foot of a tree, meditating and engaged in other kinds of tapas. Chandramshu sadrishabhasam sarva vayava shobhanam. Extremely beautiful. Chandra amshu sadrisha abhasam. Her light, her effulgence, is like the rays of the moon. And sarva avayava, all of her limbs are shobhanam, are very beautiful. Every limb is extremely beautiful. Kritva katita tevama panim dakshinatastada. Panim dakshinatastada. Jnana mudram cha bimpranam animhesha vilochanam. We'll take these lines together. Kritva kati tate vamapanim. Vamapanim, her left hand is kati tate. This is your kati at the tata. So on her waist, her left hand, and dakshinam, I lost my place here. Yeah, dakshinataha, and her right hand, jnana mudram cha bibranam. She is displaying the jnana mudra, this one. And remember that in especially in our Vedantic tradition, this is so symbolic of the non-duality that exists in spite of the apparent duality. Because duality is not just duality, but got four. Not just four, got five. These four, you remember the symbolism. This is you. Jivatma, who is accompanied by body, mind, and senses. That's not just duality, we counted four. And then there's one more. There's Brahman, the source of all. And further, these four seem stuck together and very far away from this reality or this divinity. But the teaching that's implied in this Jnana Mudra, also called Jin Mudra, the teaching, in fact, the whole teaching is there. Many of you have heard the story of Dakshinamurti Shiva. Dakshinamurti sits on the right side of our altar here and there. And the story is that he instructed the first four of the ancient rishis, and he instructed them merely with his mudra. He didn't say a thing. Maunavyakya, it says, prakatitam. He says he unfolded Parabrahma Tattvam, the reality of Parabrahma. He unfolded this reality, Maunavyakya, through an exposition of silence. How would that be? You come to a lecture and you don't hear anything, but the teaching is conveyed here. So this tapaswini had her left hand at her waist. I suppose that must look very attractive. Maybe that's the idea. Kind of, what an interesting juxtaposition. The left side very seductive lay at her waist, and the right hand in this profound jnana mudra, really showing the span of human life from the seductive to the sublime, I guess we could say. And the meaning of this jnana mudra, to remind you, is jivatma is quite independent of the body, mind, and senses. Before the body, mind, and senses exist, jivatma existed. When these no longer exist, jivatma exists. So first there's atma, anatma, viveka, which is the first half of Vedanta. That's the whole Tvampada inquiry. And then there's the second part, is the inquiry into the Tatpada. This is the Tvam. This is Vedanta. Vedanta in one hand. This is Atma, Anatma, Viveka, to distinguish what is the Tvampada, what is the meaning of the word you. Then there is a discovery of the Tatpada, Brahman, the reality because of which everything exists. That's Tat. So you got Tat and Tvam, and one more step, Asi. The entire Vedantic teachings are in that one mudra, and our tapaswini has her right hand in that jnana mudra. Jnanamudramcha vibhranam. Not only that, but animesha vilochanam. Her eyes are unblinking. She just looks out without blinking. Tyakta hara viharascha sunishchalatayastitam. Tyakta, she has given up ahara, eating, and vihara, moving around, and she is sunishchala taya stitam. She remains there, sunishchala, without moving a bit. Imagine this scene. This, our Rishi Jabali walking through the forest, seeing a gem-studded well, with his very beautiful tapaswini sitting at the foot of a tree, meditating with her eyes unblinking, chin mudra, a pretty unusual sight. So obviously, Jabali is going to approach her and inquire. Jignyasustha munivaras tasthau tatra shatam samaha. So jignyasuhu tam munivaraha. So our munivara, this great muni, this great sage Jabali, is obviously, he is jignyasuhu, he is curious, he wants to know who is this person, who is this tapaswini. But she's sitting there, unblinking, unmoving, silent. She's absorbed in samadhi. So, what do you do? What did Arjuna do when he arrived at Sri Krishna's palace before the Mahabharata war? Arjuna went to ask Sri Krishna's support in the war. Sri Krishna was sound asleep. What did Arjuna do? He sat at the feet and he waited. If Sri Krishna slept for an hour, he would have waited an hour. If Sri Krishna slept for a day, he would have waited for a day. If Sri Krishna slept for a week, he is Bhagavan, he can do anything. You get the point. So, our Muni, Jabali, is waiting for this Tapaswini to come out of her meditation. Therefore, tastau tatra, he remained there, shatam samaha, 100 years. Do you think he's patient? What is this? He waited there 100 years. Tadante tam samuttapya chalitam vinayan munihi. Tadante, after 100 years have passed, finally, chalitam, she's ready to get up and move. And he, Munihi, the sage, samuttapya, helps her rise to her feet. So, you know, apparently she starts to come back to this loka, as it were, and he samuttapya, he helps her up, and he does so vinayan munihi, with great humility and gentleness. She helps her to her feet, and then aprachat khatvam ascharya rupe kim vacharishyasi. Finally, aprachat, he has a chance to ask. Aprachat, he asked, having waited 100 years for her to come out of samadhi. He finally has the opportunity. Aprachat, he asks. What does he ask? Katvam, who are you? Ascharya rupe. He addresses her as O lady of incredible beauty, Ascharya Rupe, O lady of incredible beauty, Katvam, who are you? Kim vacharishyasi, and where are you going? You know, she got up, not for the sake of answering his questions. She got up to leave. Now, he's getting a little concerned. He's got these questions he wants to ask her. He doesn't want her to leave. So, Kimva Charishyasi, where are you heading off to? Yadi yogyam bhavet tarhi kripaya vaktumarhasi. So he requests very politely, he requests her to stay and explain. He says, yadi yogyam bhavet tarhi, if you think it's appropriate. This is a very exact translation. If you think it's appropriate, yadi yogyam bhavet tarhi, then kripaya, please, vaktum arhasi, please tell me something. And the very language is this really excessively polite. You know, when you, like, you can be not so polite, bolo, or bull, or, you know, bolie, or I think sometimes you use an even more expression. You'll say, what's it, boliega na? Something like that. Is that right? This kind of excessive politeness. So that's the sense. That's the sense here. So, I keep losing my place here. So that's his question. Atha bravichan harbala tapasati vakarshita. Atha, then, abravit, she said. Abravit shanaihi bala. Bala, that young woman, shanaihi, very slowly, abravit, began. She began to speak. And why slowly? Well, she's been sitting there in samadhi for 100 years, and she is obviously tapasa ativa karshita. She is ativa karshita, extremely weakened, and actually, what a diet! She hasn't eaten anything for 100 years, so she's gotten very thin as a result of her tapasa, due to her tapas. So she speaks very slowly, and she's rather weak, but she speaks to Jabali in answer to his question. Brahma vidyaha matula yogendra yavimrigyate. So she identifies herself. She says her name, aham, I am Brahmavidya. Brahmavidya aham. That's not a name. Vidya is a name. Many women are named Vidya. It's a pretty name. Brahmavidya is not a name. It's who she is, or what she is. So the symbolism is pretty obvious. This meditating female saint represents Brahmavidya. Extremely significant. Watch what happens here. Very, very surprising. So she says, I am Brahmavidya. I am knowledge of reality. Yogendraihi ya vimrigyate. I am the one who am vimrigyate, the one who is, I am the one who is sought after. Yogendraihi, by the best of yogis. The best of yogis are seeking what? Brahmavidya. And she says, I am that Brahmavidya sought after by all the best of yogis. Not by the middling ones, by the best of yogis. Saham Hariparamboja Kamya Yaha Sucharantapaha. Sa aham, I am she who is Hari Para Ambuja Kamyaya Sunischaran Tapaha. I am the woman who am here, Sunischaran Tapaha, doing this tapas very consistently. For 100 years, that's consistent enough. Doing tapas for what reason? And that's very unusual. So she is Brahmavidya. If she's got Brahmavidya, why is she still doing tapas? She's done. She's gained the ultimate reality. So then, why doesn't she just go and wander around or go do anything or nothing? Why does she persist in doing this very rigorous tapas? She says, Hari Padamboja Kamyaya. I'm doing this tapas prompted by my desire for the lotus feet of Sri Krishna. She has Brahmavidya, yet she's meditating, doing tapas for the sake of gaining, as it were, the lotus feet of Sri Krishna. She's going to explain further. Charam yasmin vane ghore dhyayanti purushottamam. Charami asmin ghore vane. I have come to this ghoravana, this very terrible forest. It's huge, is what it was described at. So she's miles and miles from any village, I suppose, is the context. And generally, you don't see single women in that kind of setting. So she describes her setting as she's come to this Ghoravana, to this terrible forest, to this very isolated, remote forest. She's come there. Why? Dhyayanti, for her meditation on whom? Purushottamam, on the greatest of all, on which is obviously in this context a reference to Sri Krishna. So she's come for the sake of meditation on Sri Krishna.
Brahmanandena purnaham tena nandena triptadhihi.
This is very surprising. She says, Brahmanandena purna aham. She says, I am purna. I am full. I am complete. I am filled. Filled with what? Brahmananda. Wow. She's filled with Brahmananda. Not bad. Of course, after 100 years of meditation and being Brahma Vidya herself, and 100 years of meditation, she better be full of Brahmananda. But Anande, with this Ananda, na triptadhihi, my mind, dhi, buddhi, my mind, na tripta, I'm not fulfilled. She's full of Brahmananda, but that doesn't satisfy her. How can that not satisfy her?
Tathapi shunyam hatmanam manye krishna ratim vina.
Tathapi, she's explaining why is it so that she's unfulfilled even with being full of Brahmananda. She says, even then, tathapi, even then, shunyam atmanam manye. She says, I feel atmanam, myself, I feel myself to be shunyam, empty. I feel empty, we would say, very simply. In spite of being Brahma Vidya, in spite of being filled with Brahmananda, she says, I feel empty, Krishna Ratim Vina. Without the love of Sri Krishna, she feels empty. Now, we're going to have to explain this. But let's just finish up her statement and then we'll explain. Actually, let's explain now and then we'll come back to that. How can, if she is Brahma Vidya and full of Brahmananda, how can she say, I feel unfulfilled? And here we can examine something that's almost always misunderstood. What do you think a Brahma Jnani is like? One who has Brahma Vidya, one who is full of Brahmananda. What would such a person be like, just according to your imagination? Just imagine what you think a great Mahatma would be like. Okay, just picture, you can picture someone if you think that you know someone who might fit that, and if you don't, then just imagine, what would that person be like in your, just in your imagination? Good. That person, would they have a body? Definitely. Would they wear clothes? Yep. Would they get hungry and thirsty? Yeah. If there were no food, you think they would get hungry? Yeah. If you had some food and you asked, would you like some food, what do you think that Mahatma would say? Yes, please. Not going to refuse, because even though that person is a Mahatma, they are a human being. Humanity is not lost in a process of becoming enlightened. This process of transformation from the caterpillar to the butterfly still remains an insect. Doesn't sound very nice. So through the process of transformation, it's still an insect. Through our process of transformation, we're still human beings. Human being before enlightenment, human being after enlightenment. As one acharya put it, says, before I was, you know the story, before I was enlightened, I chopped wood and I carried water. Now that I'm enlightened, I chop wood and I carry water. You wonder, what is the difference? And the answer, of course, is that before he was enlightened, he used to complain about how much wood he had to chop and how much water he had to carry. He doesn't complain anymore. He enjoys it. That's the only difference. Point is that Mahatma is an embodiment of humanity before and after. That doesn't change. Now, as a human being, has normal body that gets hungry, thirsty, etc. How about emotions? If he has a normal body, he or she, I should say, has a normal body, then he or she would have normal emotions. Does an enlightened person have an unusual body? Enlightened. Does it mean that they weigh less? Sorry, it is just absolutely silly. So the body is a normal human body. So an enlightened person, a Mahatma, Brahmagnani, has normal emotions, unencumbered by ignorance. It turns out that it's quite different, because a lot of our emotional reactivity is due to ignorance. So all of that's gone. But that apart, you know, that Mahatma has fairly normal emotions from our standpoint. If a loved one dies, they're going to feel sad, right? This, some of you have heard me talk about this before, but it's very important, it bears repeating. If you think a Mahatma never gets sad, what would that be like? You tell this great Mahatma, your best friend just died. And he goes, oh, is that so? Is that your image of a Mahatma? And some of you have heard me tell this anecdote of Pujya Swami Dayananda, my guru, who had just learned that his good friend, the great Carnatic singer Maharajapuram Santanam, who was a great devotee of Pujya Swamiji, just died in a bloody automobile accident in the middle of the night someplace in Tamil Nadu. Very unfortunate thing. Pujya Swamiji had just found out minutes before. I saw him. He didn't look like himself. I could see he was distracted or disturbed. I asked Swamiji, are you okay? He said, you know, Santanam just died. And he told me about the accident, and he got a phone call from India. And he was visibly affected. And he was, this is a, if you know the ashram is at Salisbury, what he does is he comes to the lecture hall, stands just outside the lecture hall, and drinks half a cup of coffee immediately before going in to give a class. So he's drinking his coffee. We're having a short conversation. The hall is full of people waiting for him to give a class. He just got this phone call minutes before, drinking coffee, telling me that Santanam just died, and he's visibly affected. He put down his coffee. He went in and gave a brilliant class. So he felt it, but he wasn't, obviously wasn't incapacitated or derailed. He's not the victim of his emotions. You may have heard me talk quite a bit about how we can have sadness without being the victim of sadness. And the metaphor you've heard me say before is we can enjoy sad movies. Sadness is not the enemy. Anyway, that's not our topic for right now. What we want to see in this discussion right now is that Mahatma, Brahmagnani, has normal human emotions. And if a Brahmagnani has normal human needs for food and water, are there such things as emotional needs? Huh. Human beings are social animals. You know, our ape and chimpanzee ancestors are extremely social, and human beings have always been extremely social. Yet, many Mahatmas are alone. Certainly, Brahma Vidya is alone. Many sadhus, especially those that take this parivrajaka vow, a vow of wandering. And then they go from town to town. They have no fixed place as a home. They don't stay in an ashram. They wander and wander. And obviously, if your life is one of wandering from village to village, you don't form strong friendships. You don't have family. You don't have friends. You know. What would that life be like? Now, I can guess that some of you have this really romantic image. Oh, the free life of a sadhu. Just no responsibilities, nothing that you have to do. You don't have to punch the time clock, as we say. Just wander and collect bhiksha and sit and meditate and pray. Well, you know that that's an overly romantic image, and the reality of a sadhu life is nothing of the sort. It's a tough life, a physically difficult life. You can imagine. Can you imagine going around through India today without any money? And surviving? Sadhu? You think that's easy? Forget it. Okay. Now, physically difficult. Wouldn't it be emotionally difficult to be alone all the time? I mean, to be really alone. Many of you live a life with family and friends, and chances are you're rarely alone, most of you. To be really alone is a very interesting situation. A quick anecdote here. I remember when I was a student still. I think our course had come to an end, but I was not yet a sannyasi, and I wanted to spend some time in India. And Pooja Swami Dayananda, my guru, suggested, why don't you go and stay in our Coimbatore ashram for a month? You can have your own retreat. I said, sounds wonderful. And I hadn't been there before, so I went. Well, this was in, I think it must have been 91 or so, 1991. The ashram was still under construction. There was no one living there. In fact, there were a few people who were living there. There were workers. They were literally building the ashram at that time. Of course, some of the buildings had been completed. One block of rooms had been completed, so I could stay in a room. And Pooja Swamiji's kutir had been completed. And I was given permission to use the kitchen in that kutir to make my food. So I went there and stayed in this ashram. I stayed there for a month. And it was very interesting because days would go by, I wouldn't see anyone. And occasionally I'd see the workers. And even if I saw the workers, you know, I didn't know any Tamil. They don't know any English. They're village workers, not city-type people. So, I think in that month I had two visitors. And I was surprised by what happened, because like most of you, I'm not accustomed, generally I'm with people in different situations, but to be in quite an isolated kind of context like that, I felt it. It felt odd. And somewhat uncomfortable. I felt isolated. I felt lonely. It just kind of, I won't say not lonely in the typical sense of, oh, you know, that kind of sad, lonely kind of feeling. Not like that. Just a kind of discomfort of feeling so isolated. And I came to understand that what I'm describing right now, that we're human beings, we're human animals, we're kind of designed to be in societies of people. Now, and to live alone, really alone, is just difficult. Just like the life of a sadhu wandering the countryside is physically difficult. The life of being emotionally alone or physically isolated is also difficult. It's another kind of tapas. To wander the countryside is tapas, and to be alone or isolated is also, emotional tapas. It's difficult. So, do you think a Brahmajnani could have that sense of isolation? Sure. They're human being, normal human feelings. Which is why many forms of prayer and meditation are focused on building a very warm, human-like relationship with Bhagavan. Now, this is almost counterintuitive. The Brahmajnani is one who says that Bhagavan is nirakara, nirguna, etc., etc. But that suppose the same Brahmajnani is really quite alone and lacking that very normal kind of human contact and emotional support. Well, that Brahmajnani, in spite of understanding Bhagavan as nirakara nirguna, starts to meditate not on a nirguna Bhagavan, but on, in this case, Sri Krishna, something with form, some representation of deity with very human emotional characteristics for the sake of establishing that relationship and having that emotional need met, very normal emotional needs. So this gives you a little insight into sadhu life and why many sadhus have surprisingly deep and rich devotional lives, even those practicing Advaita Vedanta. You wouldn't think so. You'd think, and you know, there are counterexamples also. You know, a good counterexample is Sri Ramana Maharshi, who, that's actually not a good example at all for several reasons. So I won't get into that. There are plenty of examples of great saints who were. Ramana wasn't isolated, is why I'm saying that. But there are plenty who lived very solitary lives, and perhaps we could say that the solitariness of their lives drove them to develop a very profound, deep devotional life. So this is why Brahmavidya could say, I feel... She said, shunyam atmanam manye. I consider myself empty. I feel empty. That's a better translation. Shunyam atmanam manye. I feel empty. Krishna ratim vina. Without that love for Sri Krishna. So even though she's Brahmavidya, she has normal emotions, a normal human need for intimacy, But that need for intimacy, that need for social contact, it can be met in many ways. It, for example, I keep going off on these, not tangents, but just explanations. Needs for emotional intimacy can be met in many ways. So long time ago, I chose to live a life of a single celibate person. Doesn't mean my needs for emotional intimacy go away. And I discussed this with my guru before taking sannyasa, and he says, don't worry, those needs will be met through just the contact with your students. And he's absolutely right. And the way he put it is, instead of having all, it's very interesting his the way he thinks. Conventionally, you get all of your needs met through one person, spouse. And he says, alternatively, you can have your needs met not through one person, but through dozens or hundreds of people, which means you're not so focused on one individual. In a way, it's healthier when there's so much intense dependence and relationship with one person. It can be problematic, you know it very well. So here, it's a, according to my guru, he says it's a very healthy situation where your emotional needs are not met through one individual, but are met in a small way by every person that you meet. So this is just to further this idea. So Brahmavidya here has her emotional needs met through her meditation on Sri Krishna. So she goes on meditating. All right. Now we can proceed. She finishes talking here. Verse 33.
Idanim mati nirvinna dehasyasya visarjanam.
We have to put the next line with it.
Kartum icchami punyayam vapi kayami haivatu.
That's the end of her conversation with Jabali. She says, previously she said, I feel empty without this love of Sri Krishna. So she says now, idanim, now, mati nirvinna, because my mind has become, she says, sad. Nirvinna means sad. She's become sad because of absence of that rati, that love, that rasa. That. What a shame it would be if being a brahmajnani meant having no emotions. How boring and dull life would be. How empty and insipid life would be without emotions. So she said she wants that rati, that love of Sri Krishna, and without it, she says that she is nirvinna, she is sad, and so much so that dehasya asya visarjanam, she's decided, dehasya asya visarjanam kartum icchami, she says, I want to give up my body. Visarjanam kartum icchami. I want to give up asya dehasya, this body. I want to give up this body. Why? Punyayam vapikayam iha avatu. Here, at this well, I want to give up my body because she's so sad, missing a. She says that she's missing the rati of Sri Krishna. It would appear that she's having difficulty meditating, and that her meditation has not been particularly successful. If her meditation had been successful, there'd be no problem. But apparently she's... Mind is what it is, and devotion, bhakti, is what it is. Do we have complete control over our emotions? We've talked about that elsewhere. So she's not able to apparently invoke those emotions for Sri Krishna. She feels very, very sad. So she has left, I think the context here is, she has left her body at this well so that she can continue to meditate on Sri Krishna to regain that sense of being connected to her. I bet some of you have had that experience of sometimes feeling a deep sense of emotional connection to Bhagavan or even to spouse or a person. Sometimes you feel that sense of connection, sometimes you don't. Normal. Sometimes you feel it very strongly, sometimes it's nothing. So apparently she is missing that feeling of connectedness to Bhagavan, so she remains there at the well. Then
tayokta mantra hagnyaya jagama manas manasam sarah.
Back to Jabali, our sage. Our sage who? Taya uktam. She has been told by her mantram agnyaya. She has instructed him with a particular mantra. And then Jabali, the sage, jagama, he went. Where did he go? Manasam saraha, to a lake called Manasa. And
tatoti duscharan chakre tapo vismayakarakam.
Thereafter, having gone to the lake, chakre, he undertook, Jabali undertook duscharam tapaha, very difficult to perform penances, tapas, vismaya karakam, amazing, the difficulty of his tapas, which will be described in the next line.
Ekaparastita suryam nirnimesham vilokayan.
You can get the meaning. Ekaparastitaha, you're standing on one leg, and suryam avalokayan, looking, present participle. He goes on looking at the sun, nirnimesham, without blinking. Staring at the sun without blinking, standing on one leg.
Mantram jajapa paramam pancha vimshati varnakam.
He goes on jajapa, chanting the mantra that he was taught by Brahma Vidya, the Tapaswini, the mantra that is pancha vimshati varnakam, a 25 syllable mantra, and it doesn't give any details as to the mantra.
Dadhyau parama bhavena krishnam ananda rupinam.
Now, chanting the mantra, meditating on what? It's not just chanting a mantra. Chanting a mantra is a good practice, no doubt. But while the mantra is being recited, there's imagery that is meant to accompany the mantra. So just to go on reciting any mantra, in meditation, you could just recite a mantra focusing only on the sound, which makes it a very yogic kind of meditation. But the kind of meditation we call upasana, that's prescribed here, is a meditation in which there's a visualization that goes along with the mantra. And it's that visualization we call dhyana. That visualization is described now. So he's meditating parama bhavena, with his full heart. He's meditating on Krishnam. On what kind of form of Krishna? Ananda rupinam. On his very full form of Sri Krishna. Now, I've given so much explanation today, we didn't even make it through the story. I thought for sure we'll make it through the story, but the explanations are, of course, I hope you agree they're as important as the story, otherwise it's just a story. But it means we won't get to the end of the story, so we'll see that in the next class. To introduce a meditation, though, just symbolism here. Note all of this is taking place in forest. Remember this. Nitya Vrindavana is all these groves and forests. Shri Krishna's Mandira is in this forest. And now we have all of these rishis wandering around in these forests and having all these amazing transformative experiences. This whole chapter has rishi after rishi wandering around in a forest undergoing transformation. Similarly, Vyasa, Narada, Arjuna will all similarly undergo transformations. And all of these transformations take place in a forest. Forest of transformation? Some of the symbolism. The forest, Aranya, is a place of transformation. The forest is a place away from your normal worldly life. It's a place removed for the sake of transformation. Guess what that forest represents? Meditation. The forest is a place removed from normal worldly life, a place that you resort to for the sake of transformation. That's what these rishis are doing. In the same place, we could say that meditation is like your own personal forest. And you don't have to travel to get there. You close your eyes and quiet your mind to get there. So the forest of meditation is a place for transformation. The meditations we do on most Saturday mornings help train the mind to abide in that forest. Generally, what happens when we're learning to meditate is you're in a forest for a few moments, and then you remember something that you've got to do later in the day, and suddenly you leave the forest as quickly as you enter it. Well, in order to do this kind of meditation, we have to train our minds to remain in the forest. And that's what we do on most of the Saturday morning meditations are a little bit like that, training the mind. So in the meditations we do in these evenings, we have an opportunity then to just be there in the forest, and sometimes not much happens. That's okay. Suppose Jab Ali is waiting for this Tapaswini to come out of meditation. He says, nothing's happening. She's sitting there, not just hour after hour, day after day. She is sitting there for 100 years. He waited there very patiently in the forest for the means of his transformation. So sometimes in meditation, not much happens. That's okay. We wait patiently in that forest of meditation, waiting for something to happen. Sometimes that's meditation too. And that's absolutely okay. So we will spend a few minutes at the end of the class. We'll return to that forest of contemplation. Thank you.
Sadhanam Prapatye Gopichana Vallabha Charanam Sharanam Thank you. Shanti, Shanti, Shanti.